For the past 20 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been dedicated to giving you the best content, from a diverse mixture of music and spoken word programs to art reviews and current news affairs. What started out as a music club is now a campus community radio station. So in this spirit, we would like to show our gratitude to all those who have been a source of inspiration and positivity which has made these 20 years colorful, fun, and full of success. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name's Hale, and with me, as often lately, is Brandon and Aaron. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm pretty well.
I'm looking forward to the show tonight. Not exactly sure where it's going, but I really liked what I was hearing during our pre-show banter, so excited to get into it.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited too. So for our listeners, the past few shows we've done together, well, the last one and some other ones we've done previously, have been around philosophy of media, media theory, that kind of thing. And so we really enjoyed doing the last show, which was on Marshall McLuhan, and speaking specifically about some key concepts of McLuhan, which were really foundational for media theory. And so we thought, why not continue on with that theme? Let's look at some other thinkers, some other people who kind of pop up a lot in this. And so we're staying within the realm of media theory, but I think we're taking it in a really different direction. And in today's show, we're actually kind of jumping off from the fact that there's so many different avenues to go down here that we're going to kind of give you a little bit of a two-parter. So I'm going to present the kind of the first half or so of the show, and then Brandon's going to present some stuff or lead a discussion on the second half. The topics are definitely going to be related. They're kind of all within the same sort of realm. I'm really looking forward to kind of where we go with that. As a quick note, in our last show on media theory about Marshall McLuhan, there was a lot of talk about technology. We used the phrase technology a lot. We used the phrase medium a lot. And during the show, I said you can kind of use those terms interchangeably. I don't take that back. However, just as a little aside, I was listening to a lecture by Neil Postman, who is another pretty well-known media theorist, technology theorist that we self-proclaimed as pseudo-Luddite, who was quite popular in the late 20th century. And so I was listening to a lecture by him, and he actually brought up this exact thing. As an aside in his lecture, he said, by the way, you hear the terms medium and technology thrown a lot and used interchangeably. He even admitted, you know, you usually can use them interchangeably, but there is a difference between the two. And I thought, you know what, it's kind of a little opener. It's worthwhile to maybe discuss that very briefly. Basically said that technology is the hard stuff. The technology is like the physical thing or whatever it might be that you use. Let's say it's a television. The medium is effectively how it is used or what is on there in the way that it shows itself. Once they're invented, once they're there, they're kind of static, but the mediums themselves have a tendency to fluctuate. And he used the example of television because that's something he wrote a lot. And he said, you know, when I write about technology of television, whether it be in the United States, which is specifically what he wrote about, or whether it be in, say, the Soviet Union, is the same technology. However, the medium is very different. For him, he wrote a lot about how television was used as a way to turn political discourse into a kind of entertainment. Whereas in the Soviet Union, the medium was more like a general information government messaging service, not really trying to manipulate you in quite the same way, almost ironically, but literally giving you like, the government thinks this, messages for you here, that kind of thing. Whereas, again, in the United States, the medium is very different. It's entertainment-based. It's that sort of kind of manipulation or two-faced aspect that he was so concerned about. So I hope that kind of cleared things up a little bit for everyone. Generally, the two terms technology and medium within this sort of realm are used interchangeably and can be, but there are times when it's probably useful to be more distinct. With that in mind, I'll get into a little bit about what I wanted to bring up today in terms of our media theory discussions. And today I'm talking about Noam Chomsky. That's probably a name that a lot of our listeners are familiar with. Noam Chomsky is very well known, became kind of famous in the 1960s as an intellectual, particularly within the context of language theory and linguistics. We're not really going to talk too much about that today, but that's really where his academic stuff jumped off of and is considered one of the founders of modern cognitive science and all that kind of stuff. But he was also very politically active. That's kind of the other thing that he's known for. He's very left-wing, kind of left-wing anarchic guy, very anti-authoritarian, very anti-American government. by and large, really realistically. And he wrote a lot about the media. Now, this is kind of a step, this is still within the realm of media theory, but it's kind of a step away from looking less at like the technological impacts of how particular mediums are used or sort of display themselves, and instead looking at media and media theory in its political implications. And particularly what Chomsky's doing, and we're, by the way, for our listeners, we're basing a lot of the discussion off of a very short book of his called Media Control. Effectively, it's a very empirical sort of work in the sense that it looks at how the media is actually used within the context of the structure that Chomsky sees within modern, quote-unquote, democratic society. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. It's really quite simple. If for our listeners at home, it's not that complicated. It's not that surprising. And honestly, this is quite a famous theory. So you might have heard it before in one way or another. Basically, when Chomsky's talking about media control, kind of going back to what we're Postman and how mediums are used differently, this is directly related to how media is functioned or used as a tool, as a techne, in modern liberal democracies, particularly the United States. It's important to remember he's talking in particular about the United States. And basically, Chomsky sees the media as a technology that's been co-opted by elites. That's essentially, like, if you want to condense it to like a really short soundbite, the media theory here is it's a technology that's been co-opted by elites. Where does this come from? Well, Chomsky sees modern democracy as basically going down a path from its original, what he calls dictionary definition. So dictionary definition of democracy, I might even butcher it a little bit, but basically, we all have a say in how our society, how our state, how our government is run. Bottom line, right? We all get a vote. We all have a say. We all get to participate. It's a participatory democracy. That's what Chomsky says in his own work. That's what you get when you look up democracy in the dictionary. You get some sort of form of that. Probably more articulate than what I had to say, but that's basically it. But what Chomsky then goes on to explain is, but that's not how we actually think of democracy, and particularly not how people in power think of democracy. They think of democracy as a vehicle for the elite class of people, the professional individuals and the business community, which are one and the same and also different to Chomsky. It's a vehicle for them to control and move society. Yeah, it's effectively that. It's a vehicle for them to control and move society. How does that look? Well, basically, Chomsky argues that there is a very small set of intellectually and politically relevant people. You could call it an elite class, effectively. He throws that number like some 20% of people, 20% of citizens. But you can think about these people who are in some way or other really, you might say, quote unquote, relevant to society functioning. They might actually participate in politics professionally, or they might not. But they're the kind of people who are educated, well-read, and generally wealthy to some extent. Their opinions matter. And they're also effectively trend setters. They might not come up with all the very specific ideas, but they are, very importantly, the people who disseminate ideas. And then there's what Chomsky really points out, and again, this is especially for the United States. I think it's probably pretty relevant for Canada as well, Western democracy in general, but he talks specifically about the U.S. It's also important to recognize that these individuals are one of and closely related with the business class, to use a super lefty term, the bourgeoisie, the upper bourgeoisie. These are this ultra-rich business people. And these individuals are the real power brokers in society. They make the real decisions. They have the real influence. And they sort of give general signals and ideas to that larger elite class of individuals who then disseminate ideas out to the rest of society. So who's the rest of everyone else? Chomsky talks about them as being the herd. For our listeners, it's probably you and I and all of us here today, and at least in Chomsky's perspective. Okay, so taking a step back, where does media actually fit into this? What's the point? Chomsky's point is mass media has allowed what he often terms in another book, the manufacturing of consent. Effectively, mass media is so coordinated and so wide breadth and so influential that the individuals who utilize it and who really control it are effectively able to create echo chambers for all of us, really, in terms of what we should think, how we should think, what sort of opinion should we have, what's relevant, what's not relevant, what's talked about, what's not talked about. And this can be used as a basically a giant media mechanism that can manufacture consent. Here's the other part, going back to the elite class, you know, those elite members are in some sense participants in the democracy. They're participants in the conversation, at least, of what is relevant for the media, what's relevant for being put up on the media structure disseminated over the mass media. The vast majority of people participate in what Chomsky terms the spectator democracy. So basically, he kind of terms it like it's a farce. You're told you have a vote. You're told you have influence. But, you know, your influence, whatever that might be, is always in relation or built out of information that is already effectively picked and chosen for you. He straight up just calls it propaganda of one kind or another. And then effectively the actual democratic process is relatively set up within this small group of elites anyways. So who you get to vote for, when you vote for them, all that kind of stuff is really heavily influenced, or at least, the relevant pieces are already picked for you, right? So you really, the great mass of people, the herd, participate in a spectator democracy. They sit and sort of watch the whole show happening, and once in a while they get to raise their hands, but, you know, when they raise their hands and to what to, or, you know, is kind of already roughly decided for them anyways. It's really Chomsky's perspective on the fact that in modern, our modern society structure, modern neoliberal capitalist, whatever you want, he would call it, it's really business and corporations that have the money and the power and the control. They are looking to make their general environment, and so obviously society, as conducive to their ends as possible. And so, you know, a lot of the discussion that comes up for Chomsky is basically around good old-fashioned propaganda of one kind or another, and structuring our media slogans and discussions in ways that are basically unobjectable, might be a way of phrasing it. You know, he uses the example of the phrase, like, support our troops, right? He basically says, you know, the modern media, modern discussions, especially that disseminated to the herd, is generally used simple, basic slogans, ideas, talking points that are very hard to disagree with or to have counterpoints to, oftentimes because they don't actually mean a lot. And to disagree with them would be a kind of social suicide a lot of times, right? He sort of says, like, who's going to say, no, I don't support the troops? So, you know, like, that's, why would you ever say that? That sounds ridiculous. The flip side of that too, and what that's kind of related to, is the sort of, I mentioned earlier, the kind of echo chamber that's created in this whole process. Chomsky talks quite at length at how modern media has a very isolating effect. If you disagree, you know, let's take a real example. It's 2003. The United States is potentially going to war. They're going to invade Iraq. Iraq has nuclear weapons. So apparently, and you know, you're watching the news, you're reading the newspaper, perhaps even reading some books. And the vast majority of what you're hearing is Saddam Hussein is incredibly dangerous. They have nuclear weapons. We need to invade this country. We're going to create a democracy in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. This is all great. You know, let's go for it. What this effectively does to people who might disagree is it not only does it isolate them, but it makes them second guess their own positions. Because if all you ever hear is the opposite of what you're thinking, then you are just sort of naturally going to presume that you are alone. And the reason that you're alone is because you're wrong. And this is the other big point Chomsky kind of comes to, which is modern media, you know, modern power politics and modern media by extension are very, very anti-social integration and organization outside of their purview. So in the United States, if you're a party or political movement and you're aligned officially with the Democrats or the Republicans, you're good to go. If you're something else, you're either crazy or weird or dangerous. You also see this within the context of the media. I thought of this one myself. If you watch a lot of, especially mainstream media, they're very suspicious of independent media and particularly independent and particularly lightly moderated discussion forums of one kind or another. For our kind of more internet savvy friends, I've got a fun one out there, which is 4chan. I was reading this and I immediately thought about 4chan, and I'll get to why, and then maybe we'll break for a little bit of discussion. 4chan is a weird place. When 4chan has come up on discussions of the modern media, it's generally talks about how 4chan is a hotbed for domestic terrorists. It's where crazy people, lone wolves hang out. It's where, you know, crypto fascists have like discussions questions because it's anonymous, disconnected, independent, not part of the main structure. People can say whatever they want. Here's the thing, though, about something like 4chan. It is a massive site, an organization, an association, full of all sorts of different discussions and people. And yeah, while there are some people out there who say some pretty ridiculous stuff and some pretty heinous stuff, and people who have been associated with the site who have done heinous things, that's most definitely a minority on such a large platform and organization, with all its large organization, with all its sort of splinter and subgroups and all that kind of stuff, right? The point is when you hear about modern media, or when you hear from modern media, you never hear about that kind of stuff. And this is kind of back to Chomsky's point that anything that sits outside of the purview of the mainstream, generally controlled media is considered very dangerous for that whole structure. And so always needs to be labeled in a way that makes it so egregious that you couldn't help but think of it as bad. You know, lots of people, way more people than like 10 years ago, know what 4chan is. And when they hear 4chan, they associate it with QAnon. Right. And by the way, it says, I don't actually go on 4chan, but that's just like the kind of the, like, I know it's actually a very, very diverse and complicated internet community. It's not just a monolith of, you know, crazy, you know, extremists, but that's not, you know, that's not the story that you hear from the modern media. And again, that's because it's an organization or a structure that sits outside of that purview. And Chomsky talks about this quite at length, that this is how that structure is used to basically attack and obscure effectively potential sources of power that are outside of that main structure we're talking about, with the business community on some level at the top, you know, and then a sector of society that's kind of considered elite, and then the herd on the bottom. And anything that potentially inverts that, any type of organization, any type of media, any type of discussion, any type of dissemination, is ruthlessly attacked or obscured or attempted to be destroyed or discredited because it threatens the system as a whole. With that, I think it's probably time to open up the discussion a bit. We've heard enough from me. Let's hear what everyone else has to say.
Yeah, thanks for bringing this topic to us, Hale. I think it was a perfect fit for the show. It's strange, especially because you would think that there'd be an easy counter argument to Chomsky's points. But that's actually kind of the problem with his points, is that it's so easy to agree with him at some level. It's really hard to know whether or not you're living in an echo chamber, or if, you know, certain things are controlled by certain elite people. I mean, I think it's very easy to prove that some elite person has some hand in almost anything. So from the type of simple validation, like from an everyday person's perspective, it's really hard to argue with Chomsky's argument, because it seems kind of like intuitively obvious that it kind of has to be this way for things to exist. And I think that's also the weakness of his argument, is that while it seems obvious when you dig deeper, as your example with 4chan kind of indicates, there's often more going on in these systems that needs to be thought about if you want to improve the system or have a discussion on an alternative system. So for instance, if the United States really is just spectator democracy, how do you fix that? Well, do we let people have more decisions about things? Like, do we have more referendums or that type of thing? Well, how do you do that except by talking to the people who are currently in charge of spectator democracy? Are they unable of reforming their own system? And I think to some degree, Chomsky would say, yes, by nature of who they are unable to reform their own system. And, you know, that maybe that's true some of the time, but I don't think it's always true. I think reform is possible. I think that real conversations and debate is possible. It might be the exception of the rule because there are other factors at play, but I think that Chomsky is essentially assuming that real change is either very rare or real democracy, or essentially what I'm saying is he's being pessimistic, but he's not necessarily giving proof for his pessimism. Or it's really hard to say how far you should be pessimistic if you believe Chomsky's argument, whether or not you should be somewhat worried, or you should be very worried, or you should believe that everything is propaganda, or a very small amount of things is propaganda, or when you receive media from like a television broadcaster, is it a certain percentage of propaganda? How do you navigate your decisions based off of what Chomsky has said, if you believe it's true?
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. And I think what something you were saying really highlighted another kind of important point for me, which is that you kind of said that, you know, the elites, and Chomsky talks a lot about the elite classes and all that kind of stuff, have their hands and everything. I think it's important to note on some level, at least from my reading of it, that Chomsky isn't necessarily, you know, saying that there is this like really thought out clear conspiracy by the elite class, by the top 20%, or even the business community, or even those in the top levels of government. It's more of a culture, or honestly, a philosophical outlook. And he talks about this specifically as something that's been going on basically since the birth of democracy, but especially since the Enlightenment period, where basically the line is there are people who are educated enough to make decisions, and then there's everyone else. And the people who are educated enough to make decisions know what's best and should be in positions of power and should direct everyone else to basically participate in that structure. It's not necessarily that like they're there being like, oh, we're going to screw everyone over. It's more about the fact that it's kind of, he describes it as a kind of arrogance effectively. And I think that that's really important to note, that there's a kind of philosophical direction and arrogance within the context of what Chomsky calls the elites. But again, as you pointed out, it's really, where do you go from there? Because the exact people that you're criticizing are also the people who are, as you kind of said, are also the people already in control. It's certainly an interesting perspective. Brandon, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I was going to bring us back to this idea, but you already did. And I think this is where we need to go with it, is this idea that there are you can break up the society into the people who know what everyone's interests are, and then the people who don't really know what is really in their own interest. The elite claim their spot by saying, actually, we know what's in your interests. The rest of the people don't actually know what's in their own interests. I think the thing that's problematic for that with Chomsky is that our interests aren't necessarily something like predetermined, or I think for him to bring this back to media, he sees that the media itself, so something like business or capital, can give people a sense of an inherent interest. So business people have certain interests, and they might use certain things to perpetuate their own interests and mistake that for everyone's interests, because if business collapses, well, then everyone is screwed. That might be true, but for Chomsky, the problem is that they determine everyone's interests in advance, when a democracy is actually where we get to come together and determine our interests together. We actually get to say, what do we want to do with our politics, with our, you know, what are our goals as a country? What do we want to do together? When you have a class of people who have interests determined in advance, and who can tell people that this is actually what's in your interest, that forecloses on the freedom that democracy promises. And I think that's what the problem is for Chomsky. To say, you know, how much propaganda, and this is another thing that I was kind of interested in, how much of what I'm reading is propaganda, how much of it isn't, how much of it is real information. It's more or less just, is what is out there predetermining what I'm doing? Is it kind of distracting me into just knowing ahead of time, like, well, obviously this is what people want to do, you know, this is what you do in your life. Things get in the way of stopping you from asking, is this really what I want? You just get presented with stuff, and media environment opens up where here's how to proceed. That might be an option, but the question is, do I really want to do that? And for most people, that's not really a question that arises, except in a kind of foreclosed way of like, here are your options in this society, and you can make your choice. But again, that's where he says, people sometimes get to weigh in, and it's not to the full extent that a person could be doing if they were to really exercise their freedom and their will.
Yeah, I really like what you had to say, Brandon. I thought that was a really kind of articulate statement on the real crux of the problem. You know, and I'm sure Chomsky has talked about this in other other spaces, although it doesn't explicitly come up in the book. But, you know, within the context of the United States, it's often pointed out that basically you have this decision between red and blue. And while these two parties often seem very different and are very vocal, especially on the mass media, about being very different from one another, it's important to, you know, an interesting piece of, is that a lot of the world's, or at least the United States' largest corporations, donate to and participate in both parties. So to Chomsky's point, the structure is engineered to benefit the elite no matter how the coin is tossed. And so, like you kind of said, if you foreclose all these other options and just make two avenues that are both acceptable to the, you know, quote unquote elites, then it doesn't really matter what people vote for, because they're going to vote for you anyways. It's kind of the point being made by Chomsky in that. To kind of end it off, I think it's really worthwhile. Chomsky really, really loves examples, and some of them are super vague and not really all that descriptive. But one point that he kind of made in talking about how this became really very propagandistic, or example, was how in the 1930s, you know, Chomsky is very interested in the labor and social movement and that kind of stuff. In the 1930s, he kind of viewed as a time, you know, a really burgeoning for the labor movement potential. And the way to kind of break that, that was used by mass media and corporations at the time that were obviously against unionization and such, was to basically say that, not to send in strike breakers and violence and all that kind of thing, but instead to say that it's actually the unions and the protesters who are fracturing society, effectively saying that they are, you know, they're un-American, they're creating, they would often say, disharmony. You know, the business community just wants everybody to get along. And so look at these protesters, look at these people trying to unionize, they're causing massive issues for all of us. And when that's, again, coming back to that kind of propaganda side of things, when that's very much largely what the media is saying, it's what the American populace, at least according to Chomsky, began to believe. And the sort of support for unions and, you know, the labor movements and all that kind of stuff started to kind of slip away from that whole sort of structure and, as he described, propaganda. With that, I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name's Hale, and with me today is Brandon and Aaron, and we're having another discussion about media theory. And with that, we've been talking about Chomsky so far, and his accounts of media control. Now, I believe, Brandon, you have something that you want to bring to the table as well, and take the discussion, probably related, but somewhere a little bit different as well.
Yeah, so when you brought up this idea of talking about spectator democracy and Noam Chomsky's idea of how the herd is kind of manipulated into having their interests predetermined for them, what immediately jumped to my mind was Walter Benjamin and his notion of the mass audience, the public, and the way that that features in his essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. Now, I'm not going to talk about the entire essay because there's a lot going on, but I think that the aspect of the mass, of a mass society, or, you know, what we would call a mass audience or something like that, features in this. And he gives a kind of genesis of a mass society in relation to the media that are emerging at the time. So I think it's kind of interesting to tie it into this discussion, specifically because Noam Chomsky does talk about the way that media has not only to be used to foreclose upon, you know, thinking for oneself, but it's also specifically just used as a distraction. Like, just pay attention to this. You don't have to worry about this other stuff. Don't worry about figuring out what your interests are. You can just engage with, you know, whatever it is that you want to engage with. You've watched TV or something like that. But the interesting thing with Benjamin is that he actually says that the mass culture comes out of the emerging technologies that are going on at the time. And the way that that is going on is through a shift in the function of art. Now, Benjamin was writing this in the early half of the, well, mid to early half of the 20th century. So he's commenting on things like photography, but specifically